content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today, Why I Am Leaving the Federal Bench. This is written by Mark L. Wolf, a senior U.S. District Judge from Massachusetts. In 1985, President Ronald Reagan appointed me as a federal judge. I was 38 years old. At the time, I looked forward to serving for the rest of my life. However, I resigned recently, relinquishing that lifetime appointment and giving up the opportunity for public service that I have loved. My reason is simple. I could no longer bear to be restrained by what judges can say publicly or do outside the courtroom. President Donald Trump is using the law for partisan purposes, targeting his adversaries while sparing his friends and donors from investigation, prosecution, and possible punishment. This is contrary to everything that I have stood for in my more than 50 years in the Department of Justice and on the bench. The White House's assault on the rule of law is so deeply disturbing to me that I feel compelled to speak out. Silence for me is now intolerable. When I accepted the nomination to serve on the U.S. District Court in Massachusetts, I took pride in becoming part of a federal judiciary that works to make our country's ideal of equal justice under the law a reality, a judiciary that helps protect our democracy, that has the authority and responsibility to hold elected officials to the limits of the power delegated to them by the people, that strives to ensure that the rights of minority groups, no matter how they are viewed by others, are not violated, that can serve as a check on corruption to prevent public officials from unlawfully enriching themselves. Becoming a federal judge was an ideal opportunity to extend a noble tradition that I had been educated by experience to treasure. My public service began in 1974, near the end of Richard Nixon's presidency, at a time of dishonor for the Department of Justice. Nixon's first Attorney General, John Mitchell, who had also been the president's campaign manager, later went to prison for his role in the break-in at the Democratic headquarters at the Watergate complex and for perjury in attempting to cover up that crime. His successor, Richard Kleindienst, was convicted of contempt of Congress for lying about the fact that, as instructed by the president, he'd ended an antitrust investigation of a major company after it pledged to make a $400,000 contribution to the Republican National Convention. The Justice Department was also discredited by revelations that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had obtained and disseminated derogatory information about political adversaries, including Martin Luther King Jr. I joined the Department of Justice as a special assistant to the honest and able Deputy Attorney General Lawrence Silberman. Soon after, in 1975, President Gerald Ford named Edward Levi as an Attorney General to restore confidence in the integrity of the department. Levi, then the president of the University of Chicago, had a well-deserved reputation for brilliance, honesty, and nonpartisanship. Ford told Levi that he wanted the attorney general to, quote, protect the rights of American citizens, not the president who appointed him. I organized Levi's induction ceremony and was there when he declared that nothing can more weaken the quality of life or more imperil the realization of the goals we all hold dear than our failure to make clear by word and deed that our law is not an instrument of partisan purpose. For the next 2 years, I served as one of Levi's special assistants, working closely with a man who was always faithful to this principle. With Levi as my model in 1981, I became the Deputy United States Attorney and Chief Federal Prosecutor of Public Corruption in Massachusetts. In about 4 years, my assistants and I won more than 40 consecutive corruption cases. Many convictions were of defendants close to the powerful mayor of Boston at that time. As a result, I received the Attorney General's Distinguished Service Award and was appointed a federal judge. Some of the cases over which I presided as judge involved corruption and were highly publicized. Most notable was the prosecution of the notorious Boston mobsters James Whitey Bulger and Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy. Both, it turned out, were also FBI informants. Agents in the Bureau, I discovered, were involved in crimes and egregious misconduct, including murders committed by Bulger and Flemmy. I wrote a 661-page decision detailing my findings. This led to orders that the government pay more than $100 million to the families of people murdered by informants whom the FBI had improperly protected. Their FBI handler was convicted twice and sentenced to serve a total of 50 years in prison. I also presided over a six-week trial of a former Speaker of the Massachusetts House of Representatives. After he was convicted of demanding and accepting bribes, I sentenced him to serve 8 years in prison. I decided all my cases based on the facts and the law, without regard to politics, popularity, or my personal preferences. That is how justice is supposed to be administered, equally for everyone, without fear or favor. This is the opposite of what is happening now. As I watch in dismay and disgust from my position on the bench, I came to feel deeply uncomfortable operating under the necessary ethical rules that muzzles judges' public statements and restrict their activities. Day after day, I observed in silence as President Trump, his aides, and his allies dismantled so much of what I dedicated my life to. When I became a senior judge in 2013, my successor was appointed, so my resignation will not create a vacancy to be filled by the president. My colleagues on the United States District Court in Massachusetts and judges on the lower federal courts throughout the country are admirably deciding a variety of cases generated by Trump's many executive orders and other unprecedented actions. However, the Supreme Court has repeatedly removed the temporary restraints imposed on those actions by lower courts in deciding emergency motions on its shadow docket with little, if any, explanation. I doubt that if I remained a judge, I would fare any better than my colleagues. Others who have held positions of authority, including former federal judges and ambassadors, have been opposing this government's efforts to undermine the principled, impartial administration of justice and distort the free and fair functioning of American democracy. They have urged me to work with them. As much as I have treasured being a judge, I can now think of nothing more important than joining them and doing everything in my power to combat today's existential threat to democracy and the rule of law. What Nixon did episodically and covertly, knowing it was illegal or improper, Trump now does routinely and overtly. Prosecutorial decisions during this administration are a prime example. Because even a prosecution that ends in an acquittal can have devastating consequences for the defendant. As a matter of fairness, Justice Department guidelines instruct prosecutors not to seek an indictment unless they believe there is sufficient admissible evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Trump has utterly ignored this principle. In a social media post, he instructed Attorney General Pam Bondi to seek indictments against three political adversaries, even though the officials in charge of the investigations at the time saw no proper basis for doing so. It has been reported that New York Attorney General Letitia James was prosecuted for mortgage fraud after Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanch, one of Donald Trump's former criminal defense lawyers, questioned the legal viability of bringing charges against James. Former FBI Director James Comey was charged after an interim U.S. attorney who had been appointed by Trump refused to seek an indictment and was forced to resign. Senator Adam Schiff, the third target of Trump's social media post, has yet to be charged. Trump is also dismantling the offices that could and should investigate possible corruption by him and those in his orbit. Soon after he was inaugurated, Trump fired, possibly unlawfully, 18 inspectors general who were responsible for detecting and deterring fraud and misconduct in major federal agencies. The FBI's public corruption squad has also been eliminated. The Department of Justice's public integrity section has been eviscerated, reduced from 30 lawyers to only 5, and its authority to investigate election fraud has been revoked. The Department of Justice has evidently chosen to ignore matters it would in the past have likely investigated. Some directly involve the president. It has been reported that a lavish April 2024 dinner at Mar-a-Lago after executives from major oil companies complained about how the Biden administration's environmental regulations were hurting their businesses, Trump said that if they raised $1 billion for his campaign, he would promptly reverse those rules and policies. The executives raised the money, and Trump delivered on his promise. The law may be unclear concerning whether Trump himself could have been charged with conspiracy to bribe a public official or honest services fraud. In addition, Trump himself may have immunity from prosecution if similar payments for his benefit continued after he became president. However, the companies that made the payments and the individuals acting for them could possibly be prosecuted. There is no public indication that this matter has been investigated by Trump's Department of Justice. As a prosecutor and judge, I dealt seriously with the unlawful influence of money on official decisions. However, Trump and his administration evidently do not share this approach. After Trump launched his own cryptocurrency, $Trump, his Department of Justice disbanded its cryptocurrency enforcement unit. The top 222 buyers of Trump's cryptocurrency were invited to a dinner with Trump. 67 of them had invested more than $1 million. The top spender, Justin Sun, who was born in China and is a foreign national, reportedly spent more than $10 million. Sun also reportedly spent $75 million on investments issued by a crypto company controlled by Trump's family. It is illegal for people who are not U.S. citizens to donate to American political candidates. And the most that anyone can donate directly to one candidate is $3,500. Ordinarily, the Department of Justice would investigate this sort of situation. There is, however, no indication that any investigation has occurred. Rather, a few months after Sun started purchasing tokens from the Trump family cryptocurrency company, the Securities and Exchange Commission paused its fraud suit against Sun and his companies, pending the outcome of settlement negotiations. Trump is not the only member of his administration whose conduct is apparently shielded from investigation. In September of last year, Tom Homan, who became Trump's border czar, reportedly was recorded accepting $50,000 in cash in return for a promise to use his potential future public position to benefit a company seeking government contracts. The FBI had created the fictitious company as part of an undercover investigation. Typically, an investigation of that sort would have continued after Homan became a Department of Homeland Security official, with the FBI seeking any additional evidence of bribery. However, after Trump took office, the investigation was shut down, with the White House claiming there was no credible evidence of criminal wrongdoing. Weeks after the FBI investigation was reported, Homan denied taking $50,000 from anybody and has said he did nothing criminal. An honest investigation could reveal who is telling the truth. There is also the matter of Trump's executive orders. A good number are, in my opinion, unconstitutional or otherwise illegal. For example, contrary to the express language of the 14th Amendment, one order declares that not everyone born in this country is a U.S. citizen. Trump's administration has also deported undocumented immigrants without due process, in many cases to countries where they have no connections and will be in great danger. Although many federal judges have issued orders restraining the government's effort to implement these executive orders, some appear to have been disobeyed by members of the Trump administration. Trump has responded by calling for federal judges to be impeached, even though the Constitution permits impeachment only for high crimes and misdemeanors, such as treason or bribery. Trump's angry attacks on the courts have coincided with an unprecedented number of serious threats against judges. There were nearly 200 from March to late May 2025 alone. These included credible death threats, hundreds of vitriolic phone calls, and anonymous unsolicited pizza deliveries falsely made in the name of the son of a federal judge who was murdered in the judge's home in 2020 by a disgruntled lawyer. Over the past 35 years, I have spoken in many countries about the role of American judges in safeguarding democracy, protecting human rights, and combating corruption. Many of these countries, including Russia, China, and Turkey, are ruled by corrupt leaders who rank among the worst abusers of human rights. These kleptocrats jail their political opponents, suppress independent media that could expose their wrongdoing, forbid free speech, punish peaceful protests, and frustrate every effort to establish an independent, impartial judiciary that could constrain these abuses. These kleptocrats have impunity in their countries because they control the police, prosecutors, and courts. In my work around the world, I have made many friends, young and old, who have been inspired by the example of American judges, lawyers, and citizens. They have suffered greatly for trying to make their countries more like ours. Among them are impartial judges who have been imprisoned in Turkey, a brilliant young Russian lawyer who was alleged to be a spy and forced into exile, and a Venezuelan law student who almost lost sight in one eye while protesting his country's oppressive government. They courageously share what they have historically been our nation's convictions. These brave people inspire me. I resigned to speak out, support litigation, and work with other individuals and organizations dedicated to protecting the rule of law and American democracy. I also intend to advocate for the judges who cannot speak publicly for themselves. I cannot be confident that I will make a difference. I am reminded, however, of what Senator Robert F. Kennedy said in 1966 about ending apartheid in South Africa. Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. Enough of these tiny ripples can become a tidal wave. And as Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney wrote, sometimes the, quote, longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme, end quote. I want to do all that I can to make this such a time. Today's second story. Feeling desolate? There's a cure for that. Written by Arthur C. Brooks. Any darkening of the mind, disturbance therein, instigation to the lowest or earthly things, together with every disquietude and agitation or temptation, which moves to discredit concerning salvation and expels hope and charity, whence the soul feels that she is saddened, grows lukewarm, becomes torpid, and almost despairs of the mercy of God. This is how Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order of priests, described spiritual desolation in 1548. He was referring to the feeling of emptiness that people tend to feel after the initial euphoria of a religious conversion, after the flush of new faith, which he calls consolation, life's troubles return. People feel they have made a mistake, and they may fall away. This desolation is not merely a religious phenomenon. It describes much of our experience when something new and beautiful sparks joy and enthusiasm, but later becomes tedious and tiresome. Marriages, for example, notoriously suffer from the so-called 7-year itch, when passion gives way to boredom and conflict. Similarly, new jobs are exciting and interesting for a while, but then become a grind or an oppression. One might easily conclude that the natural and appropriate course of action is to make a change at the point of desolation, to dissolve the relationship, quit the job, look for consolation again in novelty. But this may very well not be correct. One of the secrets to long-term well-being is to understand spiritual desolation not as a block to your well-being, but as a pathway that promises personal growth. If you know how to use desolation to get to the other side, an even sweeter consolation awaits. Ignatius described the initial consolatory phase of faith as an easy and light thing. And so it is with most big life changes when they are both voluntary and new. Novelty per se stimulates attention, which is why marketing scholars have found that simply adding the word new to an advertisement enhances consumer interest in the product offered. In particular, people who score high in the personality traits of openness to experience find new life circumstances pleasurable. We see this novelty effect very clearly in the research on marriages. In one 2010 study of 464 newlywed spouses, both husbands and wives enjoyed their highest marital satisfaction in the first 4 months after their wedding. This is not to say that divorce becomes a danger immediately after that honeymoon period. The risk of separation remains low for the first couple of years, but the incidence rises over time and peaks at about the five-year point, according to a 2014 study from Finland in the journal Demography. The data, in other words, suggests that this spike in marital desolation, characterized by boredom, decreased intimacy, and increased conflict, might more accurately be called a five-year itch. Job satisfaction follows a similar cycle, although it moves more quickly. According to 2009 research published in the Journal of Applied Psychology, people who change jobs and are committed to making a new job work, they fulfill their duties conscientiously and are socially integrated, register an increase in job satisfaction for the first 3 months. At this point, however, the consolation begins to fade, and that satisfaction declines for the rest of the year, reaching a nadir at the end of the first year on the job. This is when, in my experience, many people say they feel like they made a mistake in changing jobs. Let's call that the one-year itch. Not all marriages fail after 5 years, nor does everyone quit their job after a year. Indeed, the latest longitudinal data from couples married between 2010 and 2012 show that about 82% stay married for at least 10 years, and divorce risk continues declining after year 5, all the way until one spouse dies. By the same token, nearly half of people who have been in the same job for 4 years and about one quarter of workers stay in their gig for 10 years or more. This phenomenon of persistence has led researchers to ask how spouses or employees who stay the course succeed in getting over the hump of desolation and presumably finding renewed consolation in their marriage or job. For the secret to that, we turn again to Ignatius and what he had to say about keeping faith during the dark nights of the soul. Learn not only to resist the adversary, but also to vanquish him. That is, see desolation as a challenge to develop the skill of persisting in faith, rather than a reason to mourn the loss of a feeling you once had. So it is with other parts of life. What marriages and careers that last have in common is not that their participants somehow never encounter desolation, but that they use the happiness trough as an opportunity to learn and grow. In marriage, the couples who make it through the spell of despondency are those who grow from competition to collaboration. The early years of marriage generally involve a clash of individual wills. Researchers writing in the journal Family Relations showed that the spouses who get up past the hump and are happiest in later years have each learned to mold their will to the other's. These spouses see an increasing equality of decision-making and household responsibilities. In couples who have religious faith, this convergence also manifests as a greater degree of shared observance over time and the mutual conviction that marriage should last until death. These skills and beliefs, forged through resolving conflict, cement the couple into a lifelong unit. In most areas of life, especially those that involve maintaining relationships, periods of desolation will be part of the normal course of events. Taking our cue from Ignatius, social scientists like me might suggest three ways to turn the tough times into vital learning opportunities. 1. Stick to your knitting. A time comes in life, Ignatius exerts, when desolation cannot be denied or avoided. At such a moment, the right first move is to do nothing. One must not deliberate on anything or make any change concerning one's purpose of mind or state of life, but persevere in those things which had been settled before, suppose during the preceding day or hour of consolation. In other words, you should not fall prey to rash emotion and let it rule an imprudent decision to quit. Instead, you should recognize desolation as a normal feature of any relationship. Look at it this difficult time the way that you would regard root canal work, with calm resignation and confidence that, with the necessary dentistry, better times lie ahead. 2. Get on the same side of the table. For the religious believer, Ignatius' approach to desolation is to see it not as the individual and God on opposite sides of a problem, but you with God, facing your struggles and getting through it together. 3. Do the work. Patience is important in getting past desolation, which can last quite a while in faith, love, and work. But patience alone isn't enough. Desolation can't just be waited out. Ignatius suggests a serious program of piety and prayer laid out in his famous spiritual exercises. Marriages in a state of desolation need a similar intervention, sometimes from counseling, just as a career on the rocks can benefit from coaching. Of course, there are times when desolation can't be fixed, and the best solution is disillusion. I won't speak to the theological case, but this can certainly be true in marriages. And when it comes to work, a change from time to time can be a good and healthy thing. In these instances, we extend Ignatian's wisdom to learn and grow not just from desolation, but from the disillusion itself. I had to shorten that second article because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired.